Okay, so I know there was a lot of discussion about what we would discuss in our Navi class this year, and the pressure was on. I had been delaying a decision for many, many months, but there I am sitting in my hotel room in Yerushalayim, looking out over the walls of the Old City, and I said to myself, how can we not talk about Shivat Zion, the return of the Jewish people from the exile after the first Beis HaMikdash, and that's what we're going to spend. I don't think it'll take us the whole year, maybe a couple of months, talking about. And specifically, we're going to talk about the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, but it really is more. It's about Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, which interact. It's about the book of Esther. It's about the book of Daniel. Right? And these are the stories which, ironically, we don't talk about so frequently. When you hear a Navi class, so it's about Shmuel and Shoftim. What have we done? We did Malachim Aleph and Malachim Bet. We did Daniel, but not really within this context. And when you think about it, and hopefully what we'll learn over the next few weeks and months, arguably there is no more contemporary books of Tanakh than Ezra and Nehemiah. Talk about the day and age that we live in, the miracle of the modern state of Israel, of the Jewish people giving permission from foreign governments to return to our homeland and to rebuild it up. There is no more comparable books in all of Tanakh that you will just be reading it and you'll say, that is the world that we are living now. And all, literally to a T, all of the successes and the struggles and the obstacles and the adversity that they overcame during the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, and as we'll read, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, that is the day and age that we're living in. So I'm sitting there overlooking the Old City, talking about returning to Yerushalayim, and I said to myself, we have to talk about this. So what I want to do today, because I don't want to overload information, is really just give a little bit of the historical background and somewhat of an outline of the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. They're not very long books. It's a little bit nostalgic for me because in YU, you always had to do something called Bible. That was one of the classes you had to take. So the very first class that I took in my first semester of Bible was Ezra and Nehemiah. And it was really like the first time I'd ever studied Tanakh in my life because, well, high school doesn't really count. And you don't learn Tanakh in yeshiva. So this was like the first opportunity to really learn Tanakh in any meaningful way. And we spent the year learning Ezra Nehemiah. Okay? If those who were here last year know that in the year around 605, again, the dates, whether they're exact or not, this is what we're going to go with. The year 605, Nebuchadnezzar comes and becomes the king of Babel. Okay, of course, we know what happens about 18 years later, 18, 19 years later. Nebuchadnezzar is going to enter into the Beis HaMikdash on what day? The 9th of Tammuz. And he's going, on the 9th of Av. Tevet is when they surround the city. Tammuz is when they break through the walls. 10th of Av is, 9th of Av is when they destroy it, right? So they're going to come in 586 is when the Beis HaMikdash is going to be destroyed. Now, in 586, as the Beis HaMikdash is being destroyed, who is the prophet that is talking about its destruction? Right? Who writes Eicha? Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah, exactly. And in the context there, again, the darkest time in all of Jewish history. They've had the Beis HaMikdash for many, many years. All of a sudden, that Beis HaMikdash is destroyed. The Jewish people are sent into exile. Remember, we learned about that at the end of Malachim Bet with the various kings who were taken out. But in the context of that, so Yirmiyahu gives a prophecy which offers some comfort. He says, Kicho amar Adonai ki lefi milot lebavel shivim shana efkod etchem. That at the conclusion of 70 years, I am going to, F code, I'm going to remember you. And at the conclusion of 70 years, I'm going to bring you back to this land. Okay, now at the time, that sounded like a total impossibility. Babel was the supremely dominant force throughout the world. And the notion that they would be overtaken within 70 years and all of the horrific tragedies that were befalling the Jewish people would somehow be overturned seemed like a complete impossibility. They were a supremely strong empire. Now, we know, again, we're going to go back and forth between parallel stories, both today and throughout our study, okay? Ahasuerus is going to come on the scene, who's going to be a king of Persia, and at least according to the Gemara, and the dates get a little bit confused because Chazal didn't have a full awareness of the timeline, and so what you learn in the Gemara versus what we know historically might not necessarily synchronize perfectly, okay? But all intents and purposes, the Gemara tells us that the story of Ahasuerus, that the party of Ahasuerus was celebrating that according to his count, the 70 years had already come and the Jewish people remained in exile. Okay, so what those 70 years look like, those who remember 3 years ago now to Sefer Daniel, the very first psukim in Sefer Daniel talk about these 70 years. And we spent about 2 or 3 classes trying to figure out what the 70 years were, how they figured out mathematically. We're not going to do that again here. Needless to say, Yirmiyahu prophesizes that after 70 years, somehow, miraculously, the Jewish people were going to return to the land of Israel. And sure enough, in the year 550, Cyrus Koresh starts rebelling against Bavel. 539, Bavel falls to Persia. Something that could not have been fathomed. Again, an empire as strong and as vibrant as Bavel, within such a short period of time, falling to only 50 years, falling to Persia. Koresh, who's the king of Persia, as we'll learn about in the first 2 psukim, which hopefully we'll do today. So Koresh is going to give, B'nai Yisrael is going to give the Jewish people in the year 538 permission to return to Yerushalayim and to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash. Again, something that no one could have fathomed some 50 plus years earlier. From 538 to 516, the Jewish people are going to spend rebuilding the Beis HaMikdash, and in 516, the second Beis HaMikdash is going to be rebuilt. Okay? That is somewhat of the general timeline of what we're going to do. Now, when Koresh gives B'nai Israel permission to come back to the land of Israel, who leads them? 2 leaders, Zerubbabel and Yoshua. Okay, now what's interesting about the two of them is that they both come from the Davidic dynasty, which is important because here are 2 leaders that are going to come and they can essentially be the leaders, the kings of the Jewish people, right? So this is significant because this isn't just a political fulfillment, but this is a spiritual fulfillment as well. We know that when we talk about Malchus and we talk about having a melech over the Jewish people, it has to come from the lineage of David. And so it's significant that the leaders that are bringing them back to Israel are part of that Davidic dynasty. What's interesting is, let's talk thematics, okay? The themes that we're going to see in the book of Ezra. Number one is, from chapter 1 to chapter 6, to the end of chapter 6, you have something almost unprecedented in all of Tanakh up until this point, and that is zero criticism of B'nai Israel. Okay, those who have now been coming to this class for a number of years knows that almost, not barely a parak goes by when there isn't a little bit of the bad. Right? There might be the good, but more often than not, B'nai Israel will revert back to the bad. That's what gets us into this trouble all the time. So if you remember back to the book of Malachim, certainly Malachim Bet, so one of the things that you'll remember was that every time a new king came, what happened? 1, 2 prakim later, the Jewish people reverted back to idolatry, right? Think about when we used to do the Haftorah class a number of years ago. Every Haftorah was, what are the Nevi'im doing? They're not necessarily only giving them a yeshikayach and giving them a pat on the back, but what are they doing? They're reprimanding them. They're telling them what's wrong with the Jewish people, what they have to fix, what they have to do a little bit better. Chapters 1 through 6 that you will read are euphoric. There's no mention of any sin. There's no mention of any wrongdoing. In fact, you will have such a euphoric, optimistic outlook on the Jewish people that if we stopped at the end of chapter 6, you would come to the following conclusion. You would say it must be that this is the culmination of the redemption, that this is the fulfillment of the prophetic promises of Geula, of the redemption ultimately coming. Okay? And what's going to happen after that is going to be a little bit downhill. Okay? So when we talk about the comparisons between what we are going through in our day and age and what Ezra, Nehemiah, Zerubbabel, and Yeshua, as they're coming back to Yerushalayim, pay attention to the emotions that you experience as you read the text as well. Right? Think about our experiences in 48, in 67, this euphoria, this movement of redemption of those believing. What do we say every Shabbos? Reshit smichat gulatenu, that we believe that our return to Yerushalayim, to Israel, after 2,000 years of exile, is the beginning of the fulfillment of the gula, of the redemption. And what do we know happened over the last 50 years? So it's not always so pretty. There are ups and there are downs, right? There are peaks and there are valleys. In fact, I was just in Israel at the GA, the General Assembly of the Federations of North America, and the theme of the GA is Let's Talk. Okay, basically, the presumption is that American Jewry and Israeli Jewry are going in opposite directions. That the issues that matter to American Jewry, at least in certain movements of the Kotel, of conversion, of progressive values, is going the opposite direction of Israeli values that are much more conservative, certainly in the way that they perceive has been treated, the Kotel controversy, the backtracking on the conversion deal, all of this. Okay, now, that presumption is tragic, right? If I had told you 70 years ago that we would have a state of Israel and all we have to basically do is get along, you would probably say to me, we'll figure it out. Give me the state of Israel, give me a homeland, we'll figure out the rest. But we know that as you emerge from a new upstart country to a little bit more settled, so some of the politics, I mean, there have always been politics, but the politics come back into play, right? Think about a startup company. More often than not, the leader that founds a startup company is not the leader that will take it to the next stage because it's a different skill set. Startups are very ambitious. You need a lot of vision, right? You need to almost be like a bulldog to get your way. Once you, I call it the coat hooks, right? Once you have like a nice little lobby and coat hooks, you're a little bit more established, you have growing pains, right? Facebook is experiencing growing pains right now. They were a young upstart, their stock was high, everything was hunky-dory. All of a sudden now they're a behemoth of a company, and with that comes challenges and renewed scrutiny from the media and from the lawyers, right? So as you grow, that euphoria sometimes wears off a little bit, and now you have to figure out those growing pains. That is, Lavdil, the story of the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. Okay, chapters 1 and 6 are just going to be this unimaginable, euphoric rise. Think about the number 70 years, the year that we're in right now. Right? Think about how 70 years prior to Ezra and Nehemiah, had you told the Jewish people that they would come back in 70 years, they would have laughed in your face, which is what they did to Yirmiyahu. They didn't believe Yirmiyahu. Sure enough, 70 years later, they come back. What was 70 years before founding the State of Israel, the Holocaust? Right? Obviously, a little bit before that. But if you had told Jews in the Holocaust that within 70 years, you'd have a vibrant, productive country, right? Staggering GDP, startup nation, right? Construction all over the place. I mean, everywhere you go, there are cranes and there's building going on. They wouldn't have believed you, right? They wouldn't have believed you. So the comparison is striking in my mind, which makes it so juicy to study together. Okay, so chapters 1 and 6, you're going to notice, is this almost euphoric, perfect fulfillment of prophetic prophecies, and you get the sense that this is the Nevuah. That's theme number 1. Theme number 2, you're going to notice throughout the book of Ezra and Nehemiah, is an enormous amount of lists, constantly listing things over and over and over again. Now, if I were a historian, I would tell you that there's a reason for that. And the reason for lists is part of the way things were documented back then, etc. What we have to figure out is why, from a Jewish perspective, are there so many lists? Lists can be a good thing. or list can be a bad thing. So for example, let's take, as a theoretical, hypothetical case, a dispute about how many people showed up at an inauguration of a president. Okay? Right? Now, counting numbers can either represent what or what? What can counting numbers represent? It could represent success. Right? I can want to count because I want to show how big something is. But it can also have a negative connotation. Why? It could be small, right? I could say, look how many it is, or look how small the number is. So counting can either be good or bad or ugly. And we have to figure out why the list of names is so significant. Is that showcasing for us the magnitude of the people that came back, or is that showcasing for us the small number of people that came back? And depending on which eyes you view the story, you're going to view those lists in a very different fashion. The other thing that's very interesting to note that we'll see throughout is the contrast, or I'd say the conflict between the old generation and the new generation. Okay? If you're of those who had seen the first Beis HaMikdash, let's say you were a young child in the times of the first Beis HaMikdash, 70 years later, you're in your 80s, you're in your 90s, okay? All of a sudden, you are experiencing the storyline of Ezra and Nehemiah. What are you feeling? What are you feeling? Why are you feeling disappointment? So it's not as good as it was, okay? If you were younger, what would you be feeling? You'd be feeling pretty happy because you never knew the Beis HaMikdash. And now, exactly. So if you look in chapter 3, verse 12, and again, we're going to study this all. I'm trying to give you just like an overarching context for the whole book. The pasuk says, "Verabim me'akohanim v'halevi'im, v'roshei avot hazekinim." So the older levim and the older kohanim and the heads, "Asher ra'u et habayit harishon biyazdo," those who had seen the first Beis HaMikdash, "bochim bekol gadol," they were devastated when they saw this new Beis HaMikdash. And we'll see, the Gemara tells us that there's good reason that they felt devastated. That there were numerous things, five things that were present in the first Beis HaMikdash that are going to be absent in the second Beis HaMikdash. So despite the fact that we are so happy, nonetheless, we're still a little sad. Okay? However, "Virabim bitrua b'simcha laharim kol," and yet there are many who are filled with exuberance and happy. And those are going to be the younger people, because you have nothing to compare it to. Nothing would make you happier than the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash. Okay? So we're going to talk about lists a lot. We're going to talk about the contrast between the first Beis HaMikdash, the second Beis HaMikdash, what exactly that means, the emotions that's going to conjure up. And then we come to after chapter 6. And here we start seeing some of the challenges that emerge with the returning of Bnei Israel from the exile. And again, I will not even have to highlight for you, because it's going to be so painfully obvious, the comparisons to our generation. So number one, the very first challenge that we are going to encounter is the number of people that come back. How many people come back? 42,360. Now that could be a large amount, and when you read, as we'll read the second chapter of Ezra, you're going to think that everybody came back. You're going to think that it's an enormous population, because the text gives you that sense. And yet, we know that where is the epicenter of Jewish life? It is not in Yerushalayim, but it is in? Bavel's gone. It's in Shushan. Right? Think about the story of Ezra and Nehemiah. Where is the action? The action is not in Yerushalayim, the action is in Shushan. If I were doing a movie documenting the Jewish people at that period of time, I wouldn't send my best film crew to Yerushalayim, I'd send my best film crew to Shushan. We know that from the story of Esther, the story of the Megillah. Where is there mention of Yerushalayim in the story of the Megillah? Nowhere. It's completely absent from the story. In fact, what do we know? We've discussed and we will continue to discuss this, right? What do we know about the story of the Megillah? Well, we know it doesn't mention Hashem. Well, it doesn't mention God, but it doesn't mention Eretz Yisrael. We're going to see that it's going to talk about the vessels of the Beis HaMikdash an awful lot. We're going to have to figure out what was the sin at the time of the story of Esther. And all of that is going to have almost be the foil to our story in Ezra and Nehemiah. You're going to have to read it, so to speak, as a split screen. You can't read the story of Esther without reading the story of Ezra and Nehemiah and vice versa, because they're two sides of the coin. But it's a very different side of the coin, right? One is taking place in exile, one is taking place in Israel. Once again, the connection to our day and age, where, although now I think numerically they've said that the majority of the Jewish people in the world do live in Israel, but there's still a vibrant, dynamic Jewish life in the exile, certainly in America. And again, the comparison and the challenges of what they felt in that day and age into what we feel in our day and age is, you can't mistake that comparison. So that's problem number one. In the year 458, so a number of years after, there's going to come a leader from Persia, and his name is going to be Ezra. Now, Ezra is what? What characterization of leadership? Is he a Navi? No, he's a Sofer, he's a scribe, right? Now, the fact that he is a scribe and not a Navi is interesting. Okay, and we'll have to discuss that a little bit more in length later on. What time period are we talking about here? It's the end of prophecy. Okay, and we'll discuss that a little more in a second. So Ezra comes back. What does he encounter? He doesn't encounter what we would have hoped he would encounter. He encounters a lot of intermarriage. And that's what he's going to try to battle against. Intermarriage. He's going to battle against Jews who don't know how to read, don't have access and understanding of their tradition, right? Once again, we're going to see a lot of lists. We're going to have to figure out, once again, what those lists are doing. But what we have to appreciate is that within a very short period of time, 70 years, there are going to be Jews that can't even read Hebrew and understand the Torah. Exile in such a short period of time can have an enormous impact. Think back to 3-4 years ago when we learned the book of Daniel. What was the very first thing Nebuchadnezzar had done to Daniel in Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah? Anyone remember? What did he do to them? The very first thing that he does is he brings the youth into his palace. What does he do next? He changes their names, okay, because he wants to assimilate them. What would you do after changing their names? So if you recall, he tries to get them to eat non-kosher food. He tries to assimilate them into Babylonian culture because he realizes that if you can assimilate the youth and prevent them from studying any meaningful Torah, what will you have done? You'll have robbed a generation of access to Judaism. You'll have cut off their life source. Where did this happen in our day and age within the last 50 years? Russia, USSR, the former Soviet Union. What was their tool that they were going to use to wipe out the Jewish people? It wasn't the Haman tactic of trying to kill us. It was the Yavan. It was the Hanukkah story, where they had said that if we can cut them off from the study of Torah, if we can limit access to Jewish texts and Jewish awareness, then we'll have cut off a generation of Russian Jews. Yeah. Right, well, yeah, the only Ethiopian challenge is, we're actually going to have a whole Shabbos later on this year dedicated to Ethiopian Jewry. Our federation gives a lot of its Israel and overseas dollars to helping, assimilate's the wrong word, but assimilate Ethiopians into Israeli society and culture. There are enormous barriers. Some are tragically racial, right? Some are just access to education. Right. Think about if you come from Ethiopia. I was just in Israel, so we were just at an absorption center, so we were learning about this. But in Ethiopia, it's a very patriarchal society. So the father is the boss. so to speak. Okay, the parents are the boss. You come to Israel all of a sudden, you send a child to school, child comes home from school, says to his parent, can you help me with my homework? Parent can't read, can't write, can't do arithmetic, doesn't know Hebrew, doesn't know Judaism. All of a sudden, the parent can't help the child with their Hebrew. So all of a sudden, you have a subverted culture within the household where the children know more than the parents, and that undermines authority, that undermines their whole structure. It's an enormous challenge. All of a sudden, now children can't keep up with their homework. They can't keep up with their homework. They're more likely to drop out of school. They're more likely to drop out of school. You've now created a cycle where Ethiopians are going to be on the lower half of the economic structure in Israeli society, which is not good for anyone. This happened with the Russians. They were able to overcome it, and we'll be able to overcome it with the Ethiopians, but it's an enormous challenge, right? So yes. Okay? So here you have Ezra, you have intermarriage, you have, once again, Lys. A couple years later, about 7 years later, more than that, sorry, 13 years later, Nehemiah is going to come. One of the things we're going to have to see, it's called the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. How many books is it really? It's really one book. When the Gemara talks about it, refers to it as the book of Ezra. It was the Christians later on that split it up into two books, called it Ezra and Nehemiah. Now, once you have two leaders, one of the things you're going to have to see is what's the similarities between the two of them and differences between the two of them. And as you'll see, they do very different functions. They have very different personalities. Ezra is going to appear much more passive. Nehemiah is going to be much more active. Ezra focused much more on intermarriage. Nehemiah focuses much more on building the walls of Yerushalayim. Okay, walls in ancient times play a significant role. If you were a walled city, that was a symbol of strength and security. If you were an unwalled city, you were pathetic, okay, and vulnerable. Think about even like a campus. Okay, when they built BRS, my guess is it was not an accident that there's a wall around. There are plenty of shuls that don't have that. You could have very easily created a campus that didn't have that. Again, nowadays, you obviously would because security needs, but back then, right, walls conjure an image in your mind. It creates a what's the word I'm looking for? A what? Yes, but it sends a very significant message. When you come to a campus that has a wall or a gate, right, there's a certain opulence to it. Well, it's more, you're right, but it's more than that. You signify something. You send out a very specific symbol by having a wall, whether it's security, whether it's that this is a different place, whether, right, dedicated space, right? All of that is created through a wall. Cities back then were no different. And so for Nehemiah, as we're going to see, it's critically important to rebuild the wall of Yerushalayim, not just to combat some of the social and economic challenges that the Jewish people are going to face. So there's going to be intermarriage, there's going to be the walls, there's going to be economic challenges as well, where the upper half is going to live a much different life than the bottom half. Okay, go to Israel nowadays, top 1%, right? There are parts of Israel which are insanely expensive, and there are large swaths of Israel, not even in the Haredi community, but even amongst working people who can't earn a living below the poverty line. That's an enormous challenge in Israel, where the rich get richer and the poor keep getting poorer. Okay, so we're going to talk about that as well. That's the background, the historical background. That's the timeline. That's Ezra and that's Nehemiah. There are three other leaders that we're going to have to learn about as we learn through the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. And those are Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. Okay, the last three of the prophets. And the reason why that's obviously going to be important is they're going to be the prophets during the same time period as the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. So similar to the way that we would learn, for example, if you're learning Sefer Tehillim, you're also going to have to be learning the stories of Sefer Shmuel, because you can't understand what David HaMelech was going through unless you also had an awareness of the stories that are lingering in the background. So too here, in the same way when we learn Sefer Malachim, don't forget, what other book did we learn? We were learning Divrei Hayamim because we were comparing and contrasting two different time periods. So we're going to do the same exact thing here. you're going to have to appreciate that while Ezra and Nehemiah are dealing with it on a political structure from much more of like a one form of a leadership, Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi are going to be prophesizing about the same exact time period, and yet their focus is going to be dramatically different. So for example, Haggai is going to give you a very different storyline than you're going to get in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. Haggai is around the year 520, so it's right in the thick of things as they're building the Beis HaMikdash, right before they're completing its building. And what is he going to talk about? So we'll see in the coming weeks, he's going to talk about some of the lapses in the construction. Jewish people might not always be as motivated as we think they were in building the Beis HaMikdash, and we'll see some of the criticism that he's going to give them in why they're not more ambitious and zealous in the building of the Beis HaMikdash. Okay? What is one of the other things he's going to talk about? Well, if you learn the book of Ezra and you were just studying about Koresh, what feelings would you have to Koresh? Koresh, Persia, gave us permission to go back to Israel. Very nice. Euphoria. You'd be excited. Remember, that was the first six chapters of Sefer Ezra. Haggai is going to have a very different take on Persia. He's not going to be as excited about Persia. He's going to focus much more on their paganism. Okay. In fact, the Gemara is going to tell us that Zerubbabel, who's going to lead the Jewish people back, had the potential to be Mashiach. And the Gemara is going to say, but because of the sins of that generation, they didn't make it there. We're going to have to figure out, what is Haggai talking about? Right? It's a totally different storyline. It's like, you know, talking over each other, and you're like, are we on the same page? You're saying one thing, you're saying the other. Are you talking, right? You know, sometimes you'll read a story, and you'll read the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, or you listen to CNN and Fox News, and you'll be like, are you talking about the same event? The answer is yes, but from two very different perspectives with two very different agendas. And that's going to be some of the contrast that we're going to see between the book of Ezra and Nehemiah and the prophecies of Haggai. Zechariah, one of the most challenging books of all of Tanakh, is going to talk about the manifestation of God's presence. Okay, a lot of very esoteric nevuos, very esoteric prophecies. And chapters 1 through 8 of Zechariah is all going to take place in 2 years, from 520 to 518. So right as the Beis HaMikdash is going to be rebuilt. We're going to have to see how that compares, again, to our study of Ezra and Nehemiah. And lastly, we're going to come to Malachi. Malachi knows that he is going to be the last of the prophets. And what's interesting about the book of Malachi, again, Zechariah is a little bit longer. Haggai and Malachi are very short. Haggai, I think, is 2 chapters. Malachi is 3 chapters. So we'll be able to finish the books. But one of the things you'll notice about Malachi is that he writes about 2 generations later than the story of Ezra Nehemiah, than the story of Shivat Zion, of rebuilding the Beit HaMikdash. And what you'll see in the book of Malachi is a very different tone. A lot of that euphoria, a lot of that excitement has worn off. Zerubbabel has died. Most of the Jewish people will have chosen to remain in the exile, despite the fact that they were given the possibility to return to Israel. All of the potential that we're going to read about in the first 6 chapters of the book of Ezra is going to be lost. There's enormous poverty in Israel. All of that excitement has worn off, and the Jewish people feel dejected. They feel rejected by Hashem. And so what Malachi is trying to do is prop them back up. He's going to help them realize that God has not forsaken them, because had God forsaken them, what would have been the result? They would have disappeared. Malachi is going to tell Bnei Yisrael, no matter how rejected you feel, the fact that you're still around is a reminder that God cares about you. And of course, we know the famous writings, both Jewish and non-Jewish, saying that the continued existence of the Jewish people is the greatest miracle known to mankind. And that's essentially what Malachi is going to tell us. One of the things that we're going to talk about is the role of the conclusion of Nevuah in this entire process, right? That's happening all simultaneously on parallel tracks. Prophecy is going to end. who writes the books of Ezra and Nehemiah. We're not 100% sure, right? In all likelihood, it is the Anshe Knesset Hagdola, the 120 great elders, who live when? At the conclusion of prophecy. What do the Anshe Knesset Hagdola do? What is their arguably greatest contribution to Jewish history? It's Siddur. We know very little about them. We refer to them as the Great Assembly, but we don't really know who they were. We know some of them. We don't really know who they were, who all of them were. We don't really understand fully their contributions, but we know they were great. And we know that they were the ones who created the Siddur. The Siddur was a response to the conclusion of prophecy. And of course, we're going to talk about that as well. So again, what's going to have started in our studies of Sefer Malachim last year, basically in the year 605, when Nebuchadnezzar is going to become the king of Babel, we're going to study all the way down to, you know, the middle of the 400s, 448, 458, 445, with Ezra and Nehemiah, going even further down in generations to Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, the end of prophecy. And it's really the perfect continuation to the book of Malachim that we had studied last year, because it's the continuation of the exile of the Jewish people. We're going to talk about the ups and the downs of returning to Yerushalayim, and hopefully one of the things that we will appreciate and realize is the similarities to our day and age. I can't leave you without learning two psukim. So let's read the first two or three psukim of the book of Ezra. Okay? And next week I'll have photocopies, obviously, but I just want to learn two verses. Says the book of Ezra, "Vishnat achat lekoresh, melech paras." In the very first year of Koresh, the king of Persia, why would this be one of the first things that Koresh does? So we'll have to figure that out. Right, this is the first thing. Why? If you were a king, just conquered Babel, don't forget, this is enormous. I'll show you a map next week. It's an enormous swath of land that's controlled by Persia. What do you need this fight for? This was Nebuchadnezzar's fight. Right? What don't you want as a king? What's the worst thing that could happen as a king? Rebellion. It's the last thing you want. So what are you going to do? You're going to placate. You're going to pacify people. You're going to say, great, you want to build your temple? Gesundheit. I don't care. Right? Just stay off my back. That's how you build allegiance amongst various constituencies. So Koresh Melech Paras, Lichlot Devar Adonai Mipimir Yirmiyahu. Right? At the conclusion of Hashem's prophecy to Yirmiyahu. Remember, Yirmiyahu said, you're going to come back after 70 years. And that's exactly what happened. Heir Adonai et Ruach Koresh Melech Paras. Hashem arouses Koresh Melech Paras. Vayaver Kol Bechol Malchuto. The word goes out, a proclamation throughout his entire kingdom. Okay? Koamar Koresh Melech Paras. This is what Koresh said. Kol Mamlachot Haaretz Natan Li Adonai Elohei Hashemayim. God gave me all of this land. God blessed me. Vehu pakad alai, and he commanded me, livnot lo bayit b'Yerushalayim asher b'Yehuda, to build in Yerushalayim. Now we have to understand, in subsequent, we'll do this next week, what exactly this is referring to. Number one, via, right, the word, heir Adonai et ruach kodesh, God woke up, Koresh, so to speak. Okay, now, did Koresh, why do you think Koresh is rebuilding the Beis HaMikdash, or giving permission to rebuild the Beis HaMikdash? Yes, well, do you think Koresh davened to God that morning and God said, right, why do you think Koresh did it? Koresh likely did this for political reasons. And yet, what does the Navi do? What does the book do? Well, it attributes it to God. And now we're going to... We know other storylines, by the way, where this happened. What's the most famous of them? Paro, right? When Paro's doing what he's doing, is he thinking to himself, what would God want me to do this morning? God wants to exile the Jewish people? Fine, begrudgingly, I'll go and punish the Jewish people. No, Paro's having his own agenda. But we read into it God's divine will. Right, this is what we call, and we'll talk about this maybe a little bit in a future week, but dual causality. Right, the leader thinks he's doing it for one reason, but we know that there is a master plan. That while there are political considerations for why all this is happening, we don't read the front pages of the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal and read about what Trump does or what about, you know, Putin does. As Jews, as religious Jews, religious Zionists, what do? We read the Yad Hashem into it, right? That's Rabbi Soloveitchik's famous essay of Kol Dodi Dofeik, the six knocks. He says, don't think that this is just random. That it happens to be that, yeah, all the nations of the world got together and said you could have a state of Israel. Right? Random, happened by chance. Says Rabbi Soloveitchik, no, that's God knocking. Right? We read God into our storylines. That's what makes us religious Jews. That's what makes us religious Zionists. That's what the Navi does. That's what the text here does also. Koresh didn't do this because of God. But we understand that it was God's hand that was at play. Maybe we'll study next week, but the Gemara right at the beginning of Avodah Zarah tells us that at the end of the days, when God comes and is giving out reward and punishment, so all of the nations of the world are going to come and they're going to say, God, we deserve reward, right? Because we built the roads that allowed the Jewish people to travel on, and we built the bathhouses that allowed... God said, you are out of your mind. You built roads because you wanted to do war. You built bathhouses because you wanted to promote promiscuity. Bless you. You didn't do this because of my people. Right? God saw straight through it. You didn't do this for me. You did this for yourselves. That's the story of Paro. That's the story we're going to read about right here. Yeah. Well, it's Persia, not Babylonia, right?
Right. Isn't that possible that God speaking to Koresh? That seems strange to an idolater. Why would God even speak to him? So therefore, he must have some Judaism in his background. Who is he the son of that knew something about Judaism that he wants to promote?
Right. So we can develop that. But one thing to appreciate, okay? Who's invited to the meal of Achashverosh? Well, everybody, but we know that there were a lot of Jews there, right? We're also not sure that this was... And why did Achashverosh do that in all likelihood? Why did he make a big party? Okay? Well, it was the what year of Achashverosh's reign that he makes his party? Third year, okay? First 3 years, what are you trying to do? It's war, okay? You're conquering. Third year is when you've conquered everything, and what do you now need to foster? Goodwill. Right, so Achashverosh makes this entire party. He invites everybody because he wants, right? Don't forget, they didn't have Facebook back then. They didn't have Twitter back then. They didn't have early detection systems. Right, I was on the Gaza border on Thursday. The security and the level of security and technology and security is incredible. Okay, they know what's going to happen long before it's going to happen. Okay, voice, you know, face recognition, all that stuff. Achashverosh didn't have that. So if you're in Persia and you're worried about people rebelling hundreds and hundreds of miles away, so you're constantly paranoid about that. So Achashverosh makes a party, bringing together everyone to foster goodwill. Koresh is doing the same thing. Now, we don't know that he only did this to the Jews and didn't do this to other segments of society as well. Okay, we just only care about this storyline because it's what's important for us. But it's not entirely unreasonable to assume that as a new leader, Koresh tried to do goodwill, and he knows the Jews care a lot about Jerusalem, about the temple. It's far away from him. Honestly, maybe he cares about it, maybe he doesn't care a lot about it. So he gives it to them as a gift. He says, go for it, enjoy. Right? If it means that much to you. Okay? We could get into this more, but think about even Truman. Okay, when Truman gives permission, when Truman... What was it? How many minutes after Israel declared independence that Truman writes his letter? It's a couple of minutes afterwards, okay? If you read David McCullough's biography of Truman, Truman was not a Zionist. Truman was not a Israel-loving, you know, messianic Zionist, okay? He basically got to the point where it was easier for him to agree to it than to not agree to it. He was being... inundated. Remember that famous story where he won't even see Weizmann in his office because Weizmann is pestering him so much, and and he has to be convinced to allow Weitzman in, right? He wasn't a Jew lover. He really wasn't. But it became easier for him and more convenient politically to sign it than to not sign it. Right? That's in all likelihood what's going on here. Okay, so that's the first two psukim that we saw this week. Next week, we're going to continue on, study the first chapter of the book of Ezra. And again, we're not necessarily going to go as linear as we have in previous weeks. We'll jump around a little bit because of the way Ezra and Nehemiah are constructed to bring in some of the prophecies of Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, but to really give us a picture of the emotional, political, and religious state of the Jewish people during Shivat Zion, and to hopefully draw comparisons to our day and age as well. Everyone have a great week.